I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Engelsberg Ideas. The first words of Homer's Odyssey, Andra moi enepe musa polutropon, has been translated into English in many ways. The poet Robert Fagles had it in his 1991 translation as, Sing to me of the man, muse, the man of twists and turns. The classic 1965 translation by Richmond Lattimore had it, Tell me, muse, of the man of many ways, and the classicist Emily Wilson, in her terse 2017 translation, has it, Tell me about a complicated man. It's difficult to mount a direct assault on this poem, because the man, the andra at its heart, Odysseus, is hard to pin down. He's described in the poem as polymetis of many wiles, polymechanos, ingenious, polytelas, much enduring, poikilometes, of intricate wiles. Nonetheless, he has been given the Hollywood treatment by Christopher Nolan, featuring the usual paraphernalia of big-budget Nolan flicks, a starry cast, transatlantic accents, and big booming soundtracks. But what, if anything, does Nolan's Odyssey have to do with Homer's Odyssey? To discuss, I'm joined by Orlando Gibbs, who has a PhD in Latin literature, and writes and researches on the classical world alongside his career as an actor. Welcome, Orlando.
Thank you very much for having me.
The first difficulty about the Odyssey is its novelistic structure, or proto-novelistic structure. Odysseus is complimented as this great teller of tales, and he narrates a significant portion of the story himself. Part of the story, Odysseus's exploits at Troy, is told by a bard, Demodocus, and Odysseus is a fast talker, always weighing up how he can use words to his advantage. How much does that quality contribute to the epic sense of the poem, and how does that differ from the Iliad?
The telling of tales is a theme of both the Iliad and the Odyssey, but it just gets a much fuller treatment in the Odyssey. To a degree, Odysseus is kind of a figure for the poet within the poem. The poet's, in both the Iliad and the Odyssey, the poet's task is to invocate the muse at the very beginning of the poem and then effectively feel inspiration from the muse in order to tell the poet's tale. And what Odysseus does in the poem of the Odyssey is effectively have his own moment as an epic poet in books 9 to 12 with the Phaeacians. Telling tales is part of the Iliad, and it is more subtly interwoven into bits of the Iliad. An example may be when the Trojan warrior Glaucus meets the Greek warrior Diomedes on the battlefield in book 6. And part of epic culture and the culture of the second millennium BC is that when you meet new people, you say, what's your name? Who are you? And where are you from? This is a formula that is time and time again, you see in both the Iliad and the Odyssey. And Glaucus and Diomedes say this to each other, and they realize that they have a link via their grandfathers, that their grandfathers hosted one another and engaged in this process that is all over both the Iliad and the Odyssey, known as xenia, which is part of the Greek culture that actually Christopher Nolan deals with in detail in the film. Good xenia involves receiving your guest warmly, providing them with food, shelter. And this is something that Glaucus and Diomedes' grandfathers have done to each other in the Iliad. And where, if they hadn't discovered this, they might just kill each other on the battlefield, they tell each other stories about what their grandfathers have done. And part of these stories involve the myth of Bellerophon, who is this mythological character who doesn't feature in the Iliad, but is related to this link between Glaucus and Diomedes. And so storytelling is part of the Iliad as well. In book 9, when after Achilles has fallen out with Agamemnon and Agamemnon is upset, he sends an embassy of Greek heroes, including Odysseus, to try and persuade Achilles to rejoin the battle. And one of the things that they do is that they delivered these highly ornate rhetorical speeches to Achilles to persuade him to rejoin. And one of the heroes who is in this embassy is Phoenix, who is a hero of the older generation. And the stories that he tells are partly about his raising of Achilles. And one of the things that Phoenix says to Achilles is that your father gave me the task to teach you to be a doer of deeds and a speaker of words. And being a speaker of words is as part of being an epic hero as doing deeds, so fighting on the battlefield. And Achilles himself is a very ornate speaker and is able to tell lots of stories himself when he wants to. But it's in the Odyssey that telling stories becomes much more pronounced a thing that you do, partly because the Odyssey is much more a poem about civilization and peacetime than the Iliad is. There's no time to tell many stories in the Iliad because you've got to fight a war. Whereas in the Odyssey, because so much of the poem is about introducing yourself to new people, persuading them that you are trustworthy, telling stories is actually a vital part of just how you communicate with people. And it obviously gets a much fuller expression in the Odyssey.
You mentioned Xenia and how much that does actually filter into the Nolan film. I think you're referring to Zeus's law, which is referred to at many points. So, how does that sense translate? And, how conscious is Nolan of that kind of tradition?
It's definitely a theme that he has chosen to magnify. It is obviously vital to the original poem. And, the beginning of the Odyssey essentially features a programmatic statement of the importance of hospitality and of hosting. The poem begins, we hear this invocation to the muse, and essentially Homer summarizes roughly what he's going to be talking about, or the poet, whoever he may be. And after that, we jump right in with the fact that Poseidon is hanging out with the Ethiopians. So he's not around. And Zeus is surveying the world and exclaims how unfair it is that mortals blame gods for their troubles. And he says that, one of the mythological bits of evidence that he adduces for how unfair it is that the gods are blamed for human troubles when human beings themselves behave badly and bring their punishment on themselves, which again is another theme that Nolan chooses to highlight. And he adduces the example of the murder of Aegisthus by Orestes for conspiring with Clytemnestra to murder Agamemnon. So the first story that we get in the Odyssey is actually about the house of Agamemnon and the Oresteia. And that kind of casts a long shadow of the Odyssey as a story of hospitality gone very wrong. The one place you should expect hospitality is when you have come home after a 10-year war from your household and your palace. And the fact that Clytemnestra and Aegisthus conspire to kill Agamemnon is a very good example of, hospitality corrupted. These expectations about what should be right for you coming home, or indeed being a stranger in someone else's house, is that you should receive a hearty meal, you should receive a bath, you should receive a bed, and you should receive good conversation, and people should listen to you and listen to what's happened to you and where you've come from. And certainly throughout the Odyssey, there are repeated instances of either a stranger in a strange land arriving somewhere and the expectation being that they are taken care of. And the poem repeatedly varies this pattern, either of people receiving right hospitality, for example, Telemachus in either Pelos or Sparta in books 3 and 4 of the Odyssey, or Odysseus with the Phaeacians on the island of Scheriae from books 8 and then up to book 12 because he's telling them his story, and indeed in book 13 when they're offering him safe passage home.
Let's go into that back via through the film, because it's probably one of the major differences between the poem and the film, in that the story in the film is told through flashbacks with Odysseus as a kind of vehicle for them. And we first encounter him within the kind of linear time frame of the film as an amnesiac. They can't remember what's happened to him. He's drugged as well. Is that a kind of... It's so different from the setting in the poem. Do you think, again, that's a kind of programmatic gesture from Nolan that says that Odysseus will be... This Odysseus will be very different to the kind of fast-talking, very conscious figure in the poem.
The effect of having him essentially love eating lotus flowers in the film. There's a bit where she says, you should stop eating them. Calypso says, why are you still eating them? And he's like, I like them. I need them. The effect of that is to create this version of Odysseus that is very affected by what's happened in the Trojan War. Kind of proto-PTSD. Or, I mean, just genuine PTSD. And certainly in the film, towards the end of the film, you see a reflective Odysseus essentially saying that we broke the bonds of men and that he is the architect of this destruction, of the bonds of men, of good hospitality. The Trojan horse is a nifty little twist on the idea of abusing the conventions of hospitality that Odysseus himself does do in order to win the war. And at the end of the film, Odysseus says to Penelope, you know, what if this man that you loved couldn't bear the thought of what he'd done? And so that's very of a piece with the Odysseus that we see with Calypso in the film. He's eating these lotus flowers to forget what he's done, to forget his troubles, to forget his sufferings. This adds up to a portrait of Odysseus in the film that, as you say, lacks the, if you like, the trickster elements that are fundamental to his character in the poem. That's not to say that being a sober, more reflective Odysseus isn't part of the poem as well. His name, etymologically, is all to do with the Greek verb for I suffer and I wail and I moan for my sufferings, oduromai, which is related to Odysseus. So part of Odysseus's makeup is suffering and reflecting on his suffering and not being able to move on from it. In Book 8 of the Odyssey, when Demodocus sings a story to the Phaeacians about Odysseus and Achilles quarrelling during the Trojan War, this brings Odysseus to tears. So Nolan has chosen to magnify this aspect of Odysseus and to elide the aspect of Odysseus that is naughtier, that is more interested in how he can manipulate words, language, and trust in order to get ahead. And this does give rise to some tonally more complex decisions in the poem that you can't really feature in a Hollywood film, because otherwise people might find it quite difficult to, well, maybe they wouldn't, but I think I can understand the reason why Odysseus in the film is a lot more serious a person and not so naughty. I mean, in the film, the only joke that you could possibly describe as such in the film is when, in a flashback to the Trojan War, Matt Damon says, let's get off this effing island, or let's get off this effing beach. And when I saw it, no one in the auditorium laughed, because a lot of the choices that have been made so far had accumulated to present Odysseus as this very serious figure.
Well, I think shades of Robert Oppenheimer, actually. Mm. I mean, so to go back to the poem, we don't meet Odysseus until book five, and this means we can talk a bit about the rest of the cast of the film, but also the rest of the cast in the poem. The first books are actually Telemachus's story, who is Odysseus's son, and it is a kind of hero's journey in miniature. He leaves his home in order to save it. He returns and he deploys a kind of new knowledge that he's learnt on his travels. And he even conceals his departure, this is in the poem and in the film, from his mother, Penelope. He's cunning like his father. So why is Telemachus, within the frame of the poem, so desperate to find news of his father? Like, why is he driven to do that?
It's all to do with feeling insecure in his own household. The unit of the household, the oikos, repeatedly in Greek literature, from the very beginning, is seen as this microcosm of the whole world and the whole state. If the oikos is healthy, then the state is healthy. Clearly, the oikos of Ithaca, its kingdom oikos, the oikos of its king, is not in a healthy state. And this is repeatedly shown, the effects of this are repeatedly shown at the beginning of the poem by the fact that there's no political unity in Ithaca, there's not been an assembly in decades. The suitors remark upon this. Telemachus calls an assembly of the suitors to try and get them to, he tries to reason with them first, and he calls an assembly with them, and one of the suitors goes, we've not done this in years, what are we doing? What's the point? The suitors themselves have their own little kind of private assemblies, which points to this idea that Ithaca is turning into an oligarchy, which is very much not according to the power structures of the palace period in the second millennium BC, where a good king would rule over their people and they would be an example to all of their people. So why is Telemachus so desperate to find his father? Partly it's to do with his sense of the political instability at Ithaca at that time, and his private instability, his sense of crisis in his own identity. There's a very significant moment, which Nolan does pick up on in the film, where Telemachus, Athena, disguised as an Ithacan man, talks to, I think the Ithacan man's name is Mentes, but then in book later on, Athena's described as an Ithacan man called Mentor, but as Mentes in book one, I believe. I'd need to check it, but Athena says, you know, you are your father's son. And Telemachus is not so sure of this. And he says, how can I be sure that I'm my father's son? No man is ever truly sure of his parentage. And this is an insecurity that pops up again and again in Greek epic, in Greek tragedy, that you can only really be sure who your mother is because you came out of your mother. But there's this anxiety repeatedly about paternity. And that's partly what the introduction of the Oresteia paradigm also brings into this poem as a kind of a tense shadow that it casts over it, this idea that Clytemnestra has corrupted the house of Agamemnon by introducing another man in. Orestes is sure that he is Agamemnon's son, but if Clytemnestra has more children with Aegisthus, then this will then mean that claims to the throne are contested.
So on his travels, he meets heroes of the war, including Menelaus. What does he find out from him? And how do Menelaus' stories reflect back onto the Odyssean story?
He finds out from both Nestor and Menelaus that there isn't that much news of Odysseus, essentially. Menelaus tells Telemachus a story of how he himself tries to find out Odysseus' whereabouts, and Menelaus kind of gets his own version of his own wanderings, complete with fantastical monsters and gods. Menelaus tries to pin down Proteus, the sea god, in order to find out both how he himself can get home and also where Odysseus is. Telemachus kind of learns about, via Nestor and Menelaus, what being a respected, senior, masculine figure of the community means. He learns from Menelaus essentially what good kingship looks like in the absence of his father. And that kind of brings back to what you were saying about Telemachus coming back to Ithaca with this sense of new knowledge and new power about how to hold yourself as a ruler and about how to hold yourself as an authoritative member of your community.
In the film, Menelaus is rather different. He's a kind of brutalized figure.
Yes, I think this is one of those interesting instances where the film tries to effectively inject more trauma than there actually is in the poem. That's not to say that Menelaus isn't hard done by, and if you excavate Menelaus's history with the Trojan conflict, of course Menelaus has been through a lot. But his presentation in the Odyssey is not necessarily the presentation that you get in the film, where John Bernthal, who plays Menelaus, cannot listen to stories about Agamemnon's death because it's too painful for him. Now, in many ways, this is quite a nifty thing that Nolan has done, because it establishes this sense that all Greek heroes who fought at Troy are traumatised by it, and are traumatised by their return home, whether it be a lengthy return home in the case of Menelaus and obviously Odysseus, but also whether their return home be swift but painful in the case of Agamemnon. John Bernthal wails repeatedly and won't let Helen speak. And this is very strange, because their relationship in the Odyssey, while not necessarily rosy, is more intricate than just simply saying, be quiet, I don't want to hear this.
And in the Odyssey, they're actually kind of reconciled. And there's a beautiful scene where Helen drugs the wine so the company can talk about the wars without weeping. And Helen, in the film, is completely different. She's sort of ruined and brutalised by Menelaus. And it's interesting to me that Nolan basically inverts that theme in the Calypso episode. So it's like, you know, how much, you know, there's a drug there that allows them to speak. And in the Calypso episode, it's putting some block on his memory. Mm. You know, again, I feel like that is an accommodation of the poem to modern sensibilities around trauma and war again.
Yes, and I also think it's a simpler way of articulating, actually, the medicinal power of storytelling in Greek culture. The way that the way that words and language and narrative functions as a kind of soothing balm or antidote to the sufferings that you might be going through. This is a theme that's picked up in much later literature. I'm thinking of Theocritus's poem where you get the Cyclops singing about the Cyclops' own romantic sufferings from his love for the nymph Galatea. The framing of that poem is about a doctor prescribing someone medicine. And a metaphor that Theocritus uses is that song is, while possibly a symptom of being love-struck and lovesick, song is actually also your pharmacon, is actually your kind of antidote or drug to process your sufferings. And there is a sense in which storytelling in the Odyssey is cathartic. It's cathartic for Odysseus when he hears Demodocus singing his song. It's clearly cathartic in Book 4 with, as you say, people in being enabled to talk about their sufferings because they have had an actual drug. And Nolan flips this, and it's part of one of the many structural changes that he makes to the poem by having the lotus flower be on Calypso's island rather than be part of Odysseus's tale in the poem. The lotus eaters are one of the people that his men and him visit early on.
Yeah, and Calypso, again, is in the film, she's a kind of, again, come back to this PTSD trauma, she's almost like a therapist, you know, kind of calmly observing him, and she's the kind of a therapeutic voice. She's quite measured and she listens well. But in the poem, it's very different. And, I mean, you know, Odysseus, even when he sort of decides to leave Calypso's island, there's that very ambivalent moment where they have sex, one more cup of coffee for the road.
Yeah.
And you're kind of like, you know, what's really going on here? Because he's obviously he's clearly weeping and wailing on the beach on the island that he does want to leave.
Yeah.
But then there is this kind of curious dynamic.
The film really, the film just completely cancels out this notion that Odysseus always is thinking about his return home. When we first see him in the poem, the first kind of image of him is him weeping on the beach. When he's with Calypso in the film, he actually doesn't cry at all. He doesn't cry at all in the film at any point, from my recollection, which again is a very interesting choice, because weeping is very much part of Homeric masculinity. Achilles weeps repeatedly. Odysseus weeps all the time. No, so, in the poem, Odysseus weeps, you know, a lot. Not all the time, but in the film, there's no kind of countenancing that.
Well, I think there's one moment where Telemachus, hearing about his father, sort of wells up, and Tom Holland's character slightly gets red eyes and slightly wells up. But again, that points more towards, he's still just a boy. He can't handle the, you know, it's not this kind of venting of emotion that could be part of a heroic story.
And particularly that, you know, the catharsis that's involved in that is a fundamental aspect of when they reconcile in the poem, which again, the film changes. The film, again, a lot of it is to do with the compression necessary to cram it all into 2 hours and 53 minutes. When Odysseus reveals himself to Telemachus in book 16 of the poem, they both weep in each other's arms. In the film, Telemachus sees the Argus recognition, and then there's this kind of subtle
There's a kind of sturdy there. Sturdy man, father-son moment.
Yeah.
You know, almost everyone listening to this will know about the famous cast of monsters of the Odyssey, probably the most famous in all human culture, the Cyclops, Sirens, Scylla, and Charybdis. And the film, much of the film is really motored along by these big set pieces. So, you know, a few classicists have actually commented on that. We talked a little bit about the lack of comedy in the film, but specifically have commented on the lack of comedy in the Cyclops episode. And I think the Cyclops episode is the first moment in the film where he's trying to overcome a monster, or is the first moment of, he's got his own personal quest away from the war. And I think it's very revealing about what the film is trying to do. I mean, what were your thoughts?
It's interesting. I think the biggest change is obviously tonal, and part of that is activated by the fact that the Cyclops doesn't really speak.
Yes, because in the poem, Polyphemus is actually very articulate. He's quite a good character.
Yeah, he's almost quite funny. He says, "Oh, when Odysseus gives him the wine, that ends up leaving Polyphemus drunk and therefore not only asleep but unable to wake up from his sleep, which allows Odysseus to heat up the shepherd's staff that Polyphemus uses, heat up the spike, blind the Cyclops." Polyphemus says, "Oh, well, thank you for this wine. I'll eat you last," which is just quite a neat bit of wit from the Cyclops himself. Whereas in the film, all we really hear the Cyclops saying is something about, "Dad, they've hurt me. Poseidon, my father, they've hurt me." And Odysseus's men slightly hear this, but it's very strange that the Cyclops doesn't speak to them at all. There are many reasons why Nolan might have chosen to do this. One might be to emphasize the complete lack of civilization that the Cyclops lives amongst. Another reason might just be to other the Cyclops in a way to make him seem more scary and more challenging as an obstacle. Odysseus himself has a lot more comedy in his telling in the Odyssey. Nolan completely gets rid of the no one, the no man trick. That, I do understand why he's gotten rid of that.
Because you need other Cyclops.
You need other Cyclopes in order for the joke to have its payoff. Also, it gets very wordy, Odysseus constantly talking to the Cyclops. And a lot of the humour of the pun, rather not necessarily the pun, it is a pun eventually, a lot of the humour of the no man trick is related to the fact that the word Odysseus uses to describe himself as no man is outis. And another alternative for outis in Greek, depending on what syntactically you're talking about, is mertis. So if you want to say I am nobody in Greek, you would say outis eimi, for example. Whereas if you wanted to say let no man fight, you might say mertis majesto. And depending on what syntax you're using, mertis and outis mean the same thing. But of course, mertis is a direct homophone and homonym for mertis, meaning wit, meaning this quality that Odysseus has that is all about his tricksiness.
Yeah.
So the joke in the poem is partly just a pun, but it's also partly a revelation of Odysseus's character by playing a joke on someone. He's revealing that he is a trickster and a jokester.
Yes, absolutely. And then Polyphemus says to his friends, no one's hurting me, and they don't come and get him. I mean, there's another aspect about Odysseus's identity in the poem, that he reveals his identity to the Cyclops and by vaunting over him, it was me. While they're sailing off, it was me. It's Odysseus that did this. And in the film, he sort of petulantly fires an arrow just at him as they're running away. And it just felt like one of the biggest opportunities, really, to highlight that ambivalence. You know, because that taunting, it really reminds me of the Iliad, when warriors taunt their victims before or after killing them. It's one of the most, I think, for modern readers, if they read the Iliad, that stuff is pretty challenging, because it's really sort of gangland stuff. It's like saying, you know, it's incredibly brutal stuff. It's sort of saying, I'll humiliate your body after you're dead. You know, it's Achilles does it to Hector, and then he actually then does the terrible things to Hector's body that he promises to do. So, you know, that I feel like it's kind of the shadow of the Iliad again, that it's kind of, I think, actually sort of really suppressed by Nolan. The Iliad it's sort of in the film, but also not, in a way.
It's in the film, but it's much more just about plot rather than revealing these aspects of the Iliad through character. It would have made Odysseus's character journey in the film much more satisfying, in my opinion, if you had these moments where he was essentially a bit more unpleasant. The film toys with the idea that he is sort of not ruthless, but that he'll do anything to survive, which is part of the poem. But there's a lot more colour in the poem. As you said, there's a lot more Iliadic colour in the poem. In that moment where Odysseus says, "Ha ha, it was me, I got you," that is a lot more like, as you say, these moments where Achilles tells Hector that he wishes he could eat him raw in book 22. It's horrifying. And this does make Odysseus evolve in the Odyssey, in the poem, because he learns that actually saying nothing is the way that you survive and is a lot more powerful. The suitors, the way that they treat Odysseus when he's dressed as a beggar when he gets back home. Again, the film does kind of toy with how he's... The film's pretty good, actually, on how Odysseus is abused when he's a beggar, but the poem just has, you know, necessarily it's got more time to include a lot more colour. Odysseus, they make him essentially do a cockfight with another beggar who thinks he can beat Odysseus, and Odysseus knocks him out in one punch. A suitor throws a cow hoof at Odysseus. Odysseus also had, you know, stools thrown at him and things like that. A lot of the suitor's behaviour is kind of part of this abuse of honour, but the difference is the suitors are doing it within a household, so that's a big no-no, because they're abusing Xeniar. So I think it's a shame that the Iliadic side to Odysseus that we see really is just this guy who's ruthless to succeed.
It's also that, to just return to the sack of Troy and this kind of essential breaking of bonds that Lone brings out. In the film, it's almost as if, you know, Damon's Odysseus is observing the sack of Troy and saying, God, what an awful thing that was. In the poem, there's a moment where he, along with a pal, I think it's Menelaus, slaughters Helen's new husband, like, you know, hand to hand. It's like horrendous. He is part of that, you know, raping and pillaging and plundering. Yeah. But in the film, it's kind of like, oh, what terrible things I unleashed. Mm-hmm. And again, this sort of Oppenheimer comparison comes to mind. But again, it, as you say, that there's less room for development if you get rid of that kind of really horrifying moment.
Yes. In a way, I do sort of understand it, because one of the difficulties of the Odyssey is that essentially we're encouraged to think that Odysseus has moved on from his Iliadic self. But of course, that's the very self that he needs in order to be able to reclaim his home. And so there is a real ambivalence in the poem about taking some elements of Iliadic behaviour, being overweening, being taunting your enemies, giving way to your rage, letting it govern your behaviour. On the one hand, that is obviously destructive in the Odyssey when we're kind of thinking about the environment that it's placed in. On the battlefield, it's more acceptable. But again, the Iliad does show what its cost is to the soul, basically. In the Odyssey, that kind of rage is not welcome, but obviously it's necessary in order for Odysseus to essentially do his own little Iliad in book 22 of the Odyssey and slaughter the suitors. But again, it goes too far.
Yeah, and we can go into what actually happens in the poem. Just to remain on the kind of questing, journeying, there's a couple of kind of set pieces which are, I think, don't really demonstrate anything much other than they come to shore, it doesn't work out, they run off again. But the Circe episode in the film is a lot richer, and I think it's a broadly successful scene but sort of for reasons that reveal flaws in the film.
Yes.
So, you know, the witch Circe, she's a witch, she's on this island, she turns his men into pigs and she challenges Odysseus, and this is in the film, and she claims that all he and his men do are rape and pillage and plunder, and he's kind of responsible as their leader. In the film, she's a kind of Baba Yaga kind of character, and very different in the poem, where she's a kind of very beautiful, seductive person, much like, quite similar to Calypso. You know, how does that build a quite kind of different moral vision in the film?
It's really interesting quite how much it's different. I agree with you. I think it is successful, and I think that's partly thanks to the performance of the actress playing Circe, who I think was terrific. I think it's Samantha Morton, her name. In the poem, Circe is essentially Calypso Mark II, or I suppose Calypso Mark I, given that Circe comes before Calypso, time-wise. Circe is an alluring figure. She's not this sort of old crone that the film is kind of leaning towards her being I'm presented as. And it's part of the film's repeated kind of putting sex to one side.
Yeah.
The sexiest moment in the film.
Odysseus, of course, has sex with Circe as well.
Yes, for a year. This is something that the film also completely changes. He's with her for a day. He shacks up with Circe for a year before shacking up with Calypso for seven. Mm. The most amount of sex in the film is between him and Penelope in a flashback. Again, I think this is part of the film's desire to sort of streamline essentially a lot of the narrative drive of the story, which is that Odysseus desperate to be with Penelope again.
Yeah, but he's kind of this chaste figure. It's a little bit, and he has this kind of brooch from Penelope in the film, which he carries about with him.
Mm.
And it reminds me very much this kind of good American boy has his little photo of his sweetheart in his wallet when he's in Vietnam or in Europe. You know, that's what it really reminds me of.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Whereas, and it's got a good documentary on BBC with Simon Armitage, filmed about 10 years ago, about who's an English poet and a translator of the Odyssey, where he travels around the Greek islands, kind of, you know, opining about what he thinks the Odyssey is. But there's a very interesting interview he does with a couple of Greek sailors. Who, you know, it's such a maritime culture. You ever go to the Greek islands, almost everyone is involved with the sea in some way or other. And they talk about the infidelity in totally just pragmatic terms. It's quite interesting. They go, well, when I was young, of course, I saw, like in the poem, where I saw many places, I knew many kinds of people, and I had lots of experiences, many of them sexual.
Mm.
And this was just part of, you know, this is why I feel, and they say, this is why I feel the Odyssey is very... These scenes where Odysseus turns aside for quite extended periods of time before he returns home to the kind of, you know, mastered family environment really resonated with them as sailor people, as sea people.
Yeah, yeah.
That's and again, really that's, you know, it's just not there at all in the film. But again, for kind of obvious reasons.
Yeah, I think it's that it's what you always encounter when you do when you do put. Something with, you know, a lot of the cultural mores of the world of the Odyssey are not too dissimilar to what we would like to think are our own, particularly ones about, you know, how to treat people properly, you know, how important ideally trust is, but how easily abused trust is as well. Things like honor and respect and speaking well. All of these things, I think, are pretty live in Western culture still, but there is this. I think the attitude towards sex is different.
Yeah, and also if we come back to this Zeus's law thing, this reference to Xenia in the film, it's kind of glossed as do unto others as you would be done unto yourself, and you know we all know where that comes from and how it's then codified into liberal culture through Kantian. The Kantian imperative, and you know, it's. I feel like the film is aching to impose this kind of Judeo-Christian vision.
Yeah, and I can see why that is a tempting thing to do. It offers a lot of neat and easy answers. The advantage of doing it in particularly a poem that's composed in an oral tradition, where you can not get away with inconsistency, but inconsistency can be more part of your theme. You don't have to have a kind of unifying moral vision that's easy. You can have a unifying moral vision that's complex, but again, not that, you know, a Judean Christian answer to that kind of moral question is necessarily easy. But I think it definitely sands down a lot of the rougher edges of the moral tapestry of the poem.
Just to we've got to spin through the rest of the plot because it is a bit of. The Odyssey is a bit of a shaggy dog story, and there are lots of kind of bits. But one of the most important scenes in the poem is the underworld scene, when Odysseus, after he visits Circe, goes there to hear a prophecy. And in the film, Nolan does pull it off quite stylishly, but there are a few people missing.
Well, the most glaring omission is Achilles. And it's this beautiful moment that I think is actually crucial to understanding both the Iliad and the Odyssey. Odysseus says to Achilles, "It's great to see you, and I'm so pleased that you have achieved your goal of dying young and having everlasting Kleos being the fame and the glory that you accrue from doing wonderful deeds, as Phoenix taught Achilles to be able to do. You do these deeds, you die on the battlefield, your name is known forever. Odysseus says, I'm jealous of you. And Achilles says, don't be jealous of me. I've messed up here. If I could have my time again, I would choose to be completely unknown and live a long, fulfilling, happy domestic life. Achilles even says, to reinforce his point, I would happily be the lowest kind of serf, the lowest kind of indentured labourer, tantamount to slavery, on the worst possible estate and live a long life than have the existence that I've had. And this is a real turning point in the Odyssey, because it kind of introduces Odysseus to this idea that the sort of Iliadic dream has been missold to them as a bit of a lie. The Iliad does subtly make this point by the fact that Achilles, at the end of the poem, is miserable, and he realises how wrong he has been to be so angry and be so given to martial rage and glory as the only thing that gives you meaning in life. But the Odyssey just crystallises this point, and it signifies, basically in the middle of the poem, if you like, a moral turning point for Odysseus, where he realises, albeit in flashback, that the way to live your life is not to value the glory that comes from great martial exploits. The underworld in the poem features Odysseus' mother, which is a very moving scene. Very crucially, it features Odysseus' interaction with Ajax, who, in the Trojan cycle of stories, in the aftermath of the Trojan War, the Trojan soldiers are asking who should get Achilles' armour. This is after Achilles has died in the sack of Troy, shot by an arrow. And Ajax and Odysseus quarrel about who should get the armour. Odysseus gets the armour because he's better at argument than Ajax. Ajax goes mad and kills himself. Odysseus says, hello, Ajax. And Ajax ignores him, doesn't speak to him. And that, again, is maybe a subtler way of making the point that Achilles makes, which is not only in terms of the individual is the Iliadic code unsatisfying for human life, but also interpersonally, endlessly caring about martial valour, glory, the spoils of war, it ruins friendships and relationships and the bonds of men. In many ways, Nolan featuring those two moments actually would have been really helpful for his point. And, you know, the focus that Nolan rather places on Sinon, who's a character who doesn't occur in the Odyssey, well, one, it reveals that actually part of Nolan's research was probably reading the Aeneid, and the very Odyssean moment that Aeneas has in Book 2 and 3 of the Aeneid, where he tells the court at Carthage about his own wanderings, where Sinon effectively is Odysseus' right-hand man in selling the lie of the Trojan horse. Why Nolan has decided to have Sinon there, I don't really understand. It may well be that it's just neater for him to have one person who Odysseus's behaviour kind of impacts negatively. It may be easier for him to have a figure in the underworld who doesn't come with so much baggage. If Agamemnon were the person to say all these things to Odysseus, it might just be too complex. A further confusing thing about the underworld is the last thing I'll say is that I was really ready in the film for Agamemnon to take his helmet off, but he still didn't. And I'm baffled as to why throughout the film we never see Agamemnon's face, really. It may well be that because Agamemnon is the motivation behind Odysseus's architecture of breaking the bonds of men, so much of forming a bond with a man that you don't know is seeing his face and knowing his name and knowing where he's come from. If Agamemnon is sort of the symbol of this idea that all that matters is trade and getting one over people and business, and that's why the Trojan War supposedly is taking place, then it makes sense to hide his face. I wondered whether it was a veiled reference to the fact that Heinrich Schliemann, one of the early architects of Mycenaean Greece, who discovered the site of Troy, found this golden mask in the palace of Pylos, or sorry, in the palace of Mycenae, that he excavated and claimed to have been gazing on the face of Agamemnon.
So it kind of reverses this recognition. And Schliemann's all about showing how the... I mean, he got his wife decked out in the kind of jewels, supposedly the jewels of Helen, as if we can communicate almost directly with these heroes. So
it may also be the fact that Helen in the film, when you see her, half of her face is disfigured, and part of that is the result of having been captured in war and abused by various men, whereas Agamemnon's face, presumably, underneath his helmet, is pristine.
Yeah.
So maybe they'll comment on that, but I don't know.
It's another thing. I mean, you don't see anything really of the Trojans, because the warriors all keep their helmets on. They arrive on horses, which I guess is true to the poem, because they are a real horse people. A lot of their names mean things like they're connected with horses.
Yes, the final line of the Iliad is they're burying Hector, and the poem ends thus. Thus took place the burial of Hector, tamer of horses.
Yeah, exactly. So when Odysseus does return to Ithaca, and I think this is where the film slightly collapses into a bit of an action romp, there are two great recognition scenes in the poem, which are still here in the film, but they're massively compressed, for reasons you've talked about. You know, when Odysseus is recognised, there are two moments of these recognition moments, recognised by Euryclea, who's his old nurse, who recognises him by a scar on his leg, and his dog Argos recognises him and then dies. So, you know, those moments in the poem are carried out over quite, especially the Euryclea moment, is quite an extended scene in the poem.
Yeah, it's. I think partly it's we get a lot of the setup of the Euryclea recognition earlier on in the film, where you get a flashback to Odysseus hunting. The moment where Euryclea recognises him in the poem is a moment of real jeopardy. And Odysseus' reaction to the possibility that he is recognised is much more brutal than it is in the film. Again, we probably in modern tastes don't want to see Matt Damon put his hands around the neck of his old nurse, as Odysseus does in the poem. You know, quite aggressively telling her not to give the game up.
Yeah.
The description in the poem as well of Odysseus's hunting is much more to do with his life before the Trojan War. In the film, again, because you've got to have Matt Damon doing it, he's much older when he gets the scar. But in his tale, or rather, in the tale that the poet tells us about the scar that he gets, this is when he's a teenager going off on a hunting trip with his uncle, who is also attributed in the poem with having a lot of the qualities that Odysseus then perfects in terms of being a trickster and being a kind of clever strategist. His uncle, I believe the name is Autolycus, teaches him a lot of these things. So he's a kind of mentor for Odysseus. So there's also this layering in the poem of actually things that are really important for the rest of the story, this idea of having a role model in your life, having a mentor to guide you, something that Odysseus has and is imprinted indelibly on his body as, you know, the result of him going through this process of having a mentor, teaching him how to hunt properly and how to strategize.
Yes, because it's reversed in the film where he's sort of teaching his young
kids.
And when the boar stabs him, you kind of think, well, how did you let that happen to you? Because you seem pretty honest as a kind of huntsman.
I think the Argos recognition in the film is the thing that Nolan talked about in the press for the film as being the thing that he found the most moving, which is very reasonable. It's definitely a kind of emotional high point of the poem, and I think it's dealt with decently well. I think for my tastes, the fact that Telemachus sees it kind of muddies the waters a little bit and kind of is a bit too much clutter. I understand why he's there, because you need to have Telemachus recognise Odysseus at some point, and for them to just do grand speeches to each other isn't particularly good on film. But it did mean that, you know, when Odysseus sees the dog in the poem, it's a real... it comes out of nowhere. You really don't think it's going to be as emotionally impactful as it is. And again, this is part of what Nolan repeatedly talked about in the press for the film, which is that he found that a lot of the Odyssey was payoffs, but not very much setup. So I do understand why there's a lot of stuff early on in the film about Odysseus's dog. The dog is much more in the film than he is in the poem. You only meet Odysseus' dog in the poem when he dies. And I think that's something that you can do in a proto-novelistic structure like an epic poem, whereby you can actually pause and just freeze frame on this dog and explain what the significance of this dog is. But the film was it was moving. It was.
Just before we kind of round up on some of the bigger themes, we haven't really talked about the suitors. And the kind of main suitor, Antinous, the lead suitor, is played by Robert Pattinson in the film. And I think, Emily Wilson, in her review of the film for the LRB, says that he seems to be the only character who's having fun. And
yeah, I'd agree with that.
You know, weird, I was thinking about this, he's kind of more Odyssean than Damon's portrayal of Odysseus. He's quite guileful, he's tricksy. He's, you know, got this kind of the kind of bragging thing that Odysseus does. He does that as well.
Definitely. He's definitely got...
But in the poem, the way the suitors are dealt with, and even the women they've kind of bedded, it's much more brutal. And that isn't, you know, in the film it's a bit sort of Seven Samurai, but in the poem it's something quite different. Why is it so horrendous in the poem? And, you know, you talked about that kind of Iliadic frame coming back in the Odyssey. It's the only way he can deal with the problems of his household. You know, within the kind of frame of the Odyssey, how does the poet or the poem handle that theme? How do we respond to the way Odysseus behaves, which is, I mean, if you haven't read the poem, is deeply, deeply disturbing.
Yeah, so I mean, we'll start with the suitors themselves, which broadly speaking, I think the film nails the fact that they are essentially a troubling alternative to Odysseus's crew in terms of their appetite and in terms of how they yield to the desires of their body. Repeatedly in the poem, there is this condemnation of the figure, probably a man, who lets his stomach guide him. That's something that Odysseus, that's part of the, it's kind of adjacent to this idea of the Iliadic code, being that you are governed by your mareness, by your rage, and a lot of words for anger in Greek are also to do with your, you know, your guts and your spleen. So the suitors are effectively, you know, body first, appetite first, and that results in them spending all of Odysseus's money, eating all of his food, drinking all of his drink. The figure of Antinous is, I actually think Antinous is the greatest success of the film. And that is partly because Robert Pattinson is really good in it. And he is having more fun. You're right, Emily Wilson's review of the film was pretty damning. But he is pretty much the only actor and the only character who is capturing this really quite scary combination of fun and brutality and chaos. And it's something that Nolan has experience with working with. You know, the Joker in The Dark Knight is that. Mm. And Antinous is, yeah, he is, you know, he is inferior to his desires and his base lusts, particularly in his, you know, momentary flirting with Penelope and seemingly being very earnest in that, and then immediately going and kissing Melantho, the slave girl who is the kind of ringleader of the girls who do sleep with the suitors. What's interesting is that in the battle in Book 22, he's the person who Odysseus kills very early. He kills him first. I think Nolan's equally valid choice is to have Antinous kind of be the climax of Odysseus's slaughter of the men. And it's, yeah, I think it's really tricky to put that kind of scene on screen. The film does this very strange thing where Odysseus insists that Telemachus mustn't kill anyone. In the poem, Telemachus is like throwing spears left, right, and centre. He's wounding people. He's killing people.
So there are 108 suitors.
Yeah, it's a lot of people to kill if you're only one person. Which again was a little bit, you know, I'm all for Odysseus's power being something that is actually telegraphed as well. Repeatedly in the Odyssey, Odysseus's strength is something that the poet is really keen to emphasise. Yeah. But certainly in the poem, Telemachus and Odysseus are kind of this swashbuckling duo, and it's actually Telemachus who stops Odysseus from slaughtering certain people, such as the Ithacan bard Phemius, who Phemius begs for his life, and Telemachus says, spare him, and Odysseus does. which is interestingly another change that Nolan makes that seems quite arbitrary to me, that the bard in Ithaca is called Demodocus, which is not the name of the bard in Ithaca. The bard in Ithaca is called Phemius, and Demodocus is the name of the bard that crops up with the Phaeacians. I'm not sure what that change tangibly adds. The slaughtering scene is brutal, and I found myself in the film being really invested in it, because I think it's a real skill of the story of the Odyssey that you do... You have heard tales of Odysseus being this martial hero, and you've seen how the code of the martial hero costs him in many ways. But this is a moment where actually the code of the martial hero is really needed. And it kind of synthesizes the opposing moral views of this Homeric world really neatly. And there's this very almost amusing moment in the poem where Athena appears to Odysseus and says, "You've let yourself go. You know, your courage is waning." And this impels him to fight harder, which is very much of Iliadic flavor. The gods may appear to a soldier on the battlefield and either toy with him or impel him to fight harder or give him abilities to fight harder, as happens to Diomedes in Book 5 of the Iliad when he actually wounds Aphrodite. I think the film battle scene was, you know, as good as it could be, but I think it did slightly, and understandably, put the brake on the brutality of it. It felt a lot more, as you say, like a just killing rather than a killing that was both just and savage.
Well, in the poem, he hangs the women. I mean,
it's a very...
Those images, which is sort of immortal images from the Odyssey.
It's a very troubling scene to have from effectively the second work of Western literature. Odysseus says to Telemachus, well, he says to Eurycleia, "Tell me which of the maidservants sided with the suitors and slept with them." And then he tells Telemachus to kill them. He doesn't specify how. Odysseus says, just take them out into the yard and kill them with swords. Telemachus hangs them from one of the beams of the house with the cables that are used in ships. And the simile that they're compared to is they're compared to birds that are hunted and are strung up by their necks and are quivering. And that's the image that the poet leaves us with them there. Now, Odysseus doesn't condemn Telemachus's behaviour, neither does the poet. It's just left there.
Yeah.
And it's a really difficult thing to interpret.
And we haven't really touched on Penelope, who again is, in the poem, a much kind of... It is much more like Odysseus of the poem. Actually, to be fair, in the Nolan film, she is quite like Odysseus, i.e. Damon's Odysseus, Anne Hathaway, steadfast, you know, a bit of something about her, but is not cunning and tricksy in the way that she is in the poem. The ending. In the film, Odysseus, it's sort of, he recognises that he has broken the Xenia code, the Zeus's law, and goes into exile to pay homage to his fallen dead, sails into the west, which is another alternative tradition of Odysseus's end picked up later in Western culture, in Dante, and then in a slightly similar way in Tennyson's poem Ulysses. But Penelope in the film leaves with him, and Telemachus then becomes the kind of true king. He's got a kind of golden band around his head. In the poem, it's actually quite weird that Tiresias, the prophet in the underworld, tells Odysseus late in life to carry an oar inland until he reaches people who'd never heard of the sea, and then he's on the basis that they won't understand what it's for. And then I wonder, and this is something that Adam Nicholson in his book The Mighty Dead, which is a very good book on the Homeric world, comes back to. He claims that it's a kind of dream time of when the warriors of the poem kind of live far to the north. They're kind of the steppe warriors who've come down to the world of the Mediterranean and the sea. And this is some kind of utopian, deep utopian vision of what life was once like when we didn't have to worry about the dreadful sea, and our lives weren't so dependent on this on how difficult it is. So then he can then finally return home and die sort of happy, surrounded by his family. But Nolan's ending is quite different, and it's this kind of big civilizational claim that's threaded out in a few statements from Odysseus. What did you think about it? Does it kind of come off? Do we leave the cinema going, well, you know, I've got this kind of richer view of our own civilization?
It reminded me a lot of the ending of The Return of the King.
Yeah.
Where the hobbits and Gandalf just go because they've sort of tired, and, you know, they're going into the undying lands as a kind of, essentially, you know, we're bowing out of the world and
well,
living here.
Yeah, well, Frodo
goes.
He goes because he's sort of so traumatised by the journeys.
Whereas this felt a little bit like exile because you have unwittingly given way to this world where people don't trust each other anymore, or people manipulate each other's trust. So again, it has its own quite neat internal logic. On Tiresias' prophecy, again, it seems totally arbitrary to me why Sinon is the person in the film who says this stuff about going to the West. The sea is a really interesting theme and topic that the Odyssey introduces us to. A lot of classical literature talks about how evil the sea is and how it ushers in this period where essentially everything goes wrong for mankind, and it brings out the worst in mankind through trade, war, interacting with people that you never should have interacted with, supposedly. It's part of the Golden Age rhetoric that first pops up in Hesiod's poem, The Works and Days, which is a didactic poem written in a very similar way to how the Homeric poems are written, and essentially goes through the ages of humankind. And the Golden Age is a period before seafaring, basically. And one thing that the Odyssey, the poem, it's almost funny to me that as soon as Odysseus gets home, he's got to leave again on his own to take this winnowing fan to these people who have never seen the sea. I can see why thematically the poem does this, because it is essentially it's essentially tying a neat bow around Odysseus's time on the sea. And he does arrive home, and he does rekindle and reunite with Penelope. But there is this question mark over the trauma that he has faced at sea. And so it makes sense to me, in a kind of ritualistic logic, that he should receive this prophecy, that he will only truly return home and be at peace once he has, if you like, expiated his offence of Poseidon. Mm. Because this is the whole kind of matchstick moment for the whole thing that lights the match for Odysseus' sufferings is his offending of Poseidon via his hubris against Polyphemus, Poseidon's son. Was the film's version of that, where Odysseus goes into exile with Penelope to sort of essentially go on a retiree cruise? I think what it offered us was essentially a recognition that a film that purports to be about how civilization fixes itself often involves some kind of ostracism or removal of a kind of poisonous element or a problematic or corrupt element. And for Odysseus's, for that to be framed as a kind of self-sacrifice for Odysseus does sort of tap into the Judeo-Christian imagery that the film is trying to kind of graft onto the poem. And it certainly suggested this idea of Odysseus as the many enduring figure, the man who has to suffer loads and endure lots of wanderings. It was kind of a happy ending in a way. Yeah. It definitely gave the sense that the film ended in a satisfactory, you know, but both Odysseus' punishment for what he has done, but also his reward for getting home, is that he gets to go into exile, but with Penelope. It's Nolan's choice. I'm not sure it's what I would choose, but I'm not Christopher Nolan.
I think it is good that the classical world, you know, people will go out and buy the Odyssey and read it. You know, that, you know, it's a great, interesting poem, and there's lots to think about with it. What texts are there in the classical world that maybe are ripe for an adaptation? I mean, the thing that when I was watching the film, the warrior scenes and Odysseus' travels, it made me think, well, Xenophon's Anabasis would be great for this kind of film. Like a group of men stranded in a faraway land who have to make it back to Greece and go through various perils. It kind of fits more with the kind of all that kind of Vietnam War tradition in American cinema, where, you know, it is a group of men stranded somewhere and they're trying to work out what to do, whether that's Platoon or Full Metal Jacket or Apocalypse Now. But yeah, what texts are out there that could work for a kind of big epic Hollywood film?
It's a really interesting question. I'd be surprised if Christopher Nolan himself ever did another classical film. I'm not saying he won't, but, you know, it seems to me that he likes to mix up his repertoire quite a lot. I mentioned the Aeneid. I think the Aeneid has a very satisfying structure to it. I think the Aeneid also, in its own format that we have it, asks some very important and potent questions about the cost of progress and the cost of a civilization in the form that we would recognize it, in the foundation of something that will become the Roman Empire, as Aeneas is tasked with doing from leaving Troy. It sort of infuses big historical questions about winners and losers in history with an epic tone, with this idea that the Homeric Code still lives and it is still something that particularly men are having to grapple with, although there are some brilliant female characters in the Aeneid as well. And you'd get, you know, Aeneas's romantic dalliance with Dido, you'd get another brilliant underworld scene. I think the Aeneid would make an interesting film. In terms of works of literature, but that have very much a basis in the real world, that are about that kind of period of Roman history, Sallust's description of the Catilinarian conspiracy in the late Roman Republic, which features this aggrieved politician Catiline not being given the consulship, which is the highest form of Roman office, and being effectively thwarted by Cicero and then put to death. The Sallust's work of history about this conspiracy, but that reads more like a novel, I think would make a pretty exciting film. And something that has a little bit more of a silly flavour to it, I think the novel written by Apuleius, which is called Metamorphoses, but which we typically translate in English as The Golden Ass, where this chap called Lucius goes on a little adventure and ends up being transformed into a donkey and has to figure out how to get out of donkey form, I think would be, if it were trimmed down and everything, I think that would be quite a fun extension of what appears to be going on, which is a renewed interest in presenting the classical world in digestible formats for the general readership and viewership. And the good thing about something like the Sallust or the Apuleius is that they are well known and widely worked on within academic communities and sometimes studied at the school level, but I think they would be sufficiently niche to kind of expand this interest in the classical world.
Well, thank you, Orlando, and thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.